This is the sixth day of this October 2009 seven-day session. And we'll take up a koan today. This is from the Mumon Khan collection. Number 29, Neither the Wind Nor the Flag. For the sake of beginners, I have to say just a little bit about the Mumon Khan. It's the best known collection of koans. These collections of koans as well. These are from ancient China, and they were all compiled. These 48 koans in this collection were compiled by a Chinese master, Mumon, or to use his Chinese name, Wu Men. And so he presented what he calls the case for each of these 48 koans, and then after each case, he puts his own commentary and verse. So, first, the case. The wind was flapping a temple flag, and two monks started an argument about it. One said the flag was moving, the other that the wind was moving. Arguing back and forth, they could come to no agreement. The patriarch said, "It is not the wind that is moving, it is not the flag that is moving, it is your honorable mind that is moving." The two monks were struck with awe. The patriarch refers to the sixth patriarch, Huainong, who is arguably the second most influential of all of the Zen masters, second after Bodhidharma. Some might say even more important than Bodhidharma, because it was Huainong, a Chinese, of course, who gave the particular quality to Zen that makes it what it is, how we know it. I mean, Bodhidharma is credited as the founder. He is the first to center his practice and training on wall gazing. He was called the wall gazing Brahmin. But Zen as we know it has a distinctly East Asian quality to it, and it was Huainong who really gave it his imprimatur and made it what it is. I'll read just a little bit about Huainong. So Bodhidharma is, of course, considered the first patriarch of Zen, and then Huainong, a few generations after him, is the sixth. Very briefly, Huainong is famous for having had an initial awakening, just hearing hearing the Diamond Sutra recited. He lived in abject poverty and made a few pennies collecting and delivering firewood, and once, when he was on his rounds, he heard the Diamond Sutra recited and his mind came to awakening. And then he found his way to the great big monastery of the fifth patriarch, and spent his first 8 months there just pounding rice. And then there was this contest that the fifth patriarch set up where Huainong's verse written on the wall was understood as the showing more profound understanding than the head monk's verse. And the fifth patriarch transmitted the Dharma to him in the dead of night. And as he was doing so, Wei Nong came to a much deeper realization, deep enlightenment. And because of the unsavory elements in the monastery at the time, the fifth patriarch urged him to take off, because there would be those who would begrudge him the robe and bowl. And he spent the next 14 years, by some accounts 16 years, let's make it 15, next 15 years, living in the woods with a band of hunters, according to the legend. It's very hard to know how much of this is literally true. And the purpose of that period where he was dormant was because he was so young when he came to the, when he had his initial awakening and then went to the monastery. He was only something like 20 or 23, and he and his teacher both knew that he needed seasoning and he needed maturing. So he had the wisdom to stay out with ordinary men. They said that, according to the record, he would just when the hunters had their meat stew, he would just fish out the vegetables and eat only the vegetables. In any case, it was after he emerged from the woods that this exchange is said to have occurred. Just a couple of dialogues or teachings here by Wei Nong. I'm reading from the book Zen's Chinese Heritage, The Masters and Their Teachings, edited by Andy Ferguson. Andy Ferguson is a Buddhist scholar who has given a couple of talks at the center and will be doing another one sometime in the not distant future. Here's a passage by him. In this school of Buddhism, Zen, or Chan, that's what it was called in China. In Chan, what is it we call sitting in Zen meditation? In performing this practice, no impediments exist. When no thoughts arise with respect to what is external, this is sitting. When one calmly observes original nature, this is Zen. So what is sitting meditation, or Zazen, as we might say? Detachment from external things is Zen. When internally the mind is composed, this is samadhi. If one clings to external forms, then internally the mind is scattered and confused. If one is unattached to external forms, then internally the mind is composed. Original nature has self-purity and self-composure. It is only when, through causation, some condition is encountered, the confusion arises. Remaining apart from form, one remains unperturbed, and samadhi is realized. Externally, Zen. Internally, samadhi. Together, they are called sitting Zen. When he says external forms, that would include thoughts. I guess I just mean objects, physical objects. These thoughts that we objectify, that we tend to see as something in our mind. That's really the key detachment in Zen, is detaching from our thoughts, not clinging to them. I'll just cut to his last statement as he was dying. Each of you practice this well. Today I say goodbye to you. After I die, don't mourn me in the usual manner of the world. If you receive other people's condolences, offerings, and observances, or you wear mourning clothes, then this is not the true school, and you are not my disciples. You should act as though I were still in the world, sitting completely upright, not moving nor resting, without creation or passing away, not coming or going, without positive or negative, not abiding or leaving, but just in solitary peace. This is the great way. After I die, just go on practicing as before, as though I were still here. When I am in the world and you go against my teaching, it is as though my life here as abbot was meaningless. And when he finished saying these words, he suddenly died. This is at the age of 76. By the way, his dates are 638 to 713. There were these in China. There were these five schools of Chan. These were comprised most of the great masters that we're familiar with, that came down to us at least, and they all trace their origin through this sixth patriarch, Hui Neng. Okay, we'll leave it at that this time, and go on back to the case. The wind was flapping a temple flag. We adopted the custom that this refers to where on the day of a talk by the teacher or even other events, there is a flag that is hoisted up, and there might be different flags. We do this. We have a flag that shows the Enso, that is the circle calligraphy. We have a flag showing a Doksan bell on days or nights when they're Doksan. We have a flag showing the endless knot, which is an old and ancient representation of the interdependence of things. We have one of a phoenix rising from the ashes, and others. And here, this flapping of the flag started an argument between two monks. And this, the two sides, where one said the flag was moving, the other that the wind was moving, these we can understand as one taking the argument of subjectivity and the other of objectivity. So, certainly no one can deny that the flag was moving. You can see with your own eyes that it's moving. But the argument of the other monk was that it wasn't on its own power, that it wouldn't be moving if it weren't for the wind. So it's really the wind that's the prime mover there. But the other monk, of course, pointed to that flapping flag and said, "Hello, there's the flag flapping." And the other monk would say, "Yeah, but it is the cause, really the cause is the wind. And oh, it must have been a slow day at the monastery." But they got into it, and we're just left to fill in the rest. They're probably, because there were so many idle monks in these big monasteries, there was a crowd that formed around them, just as if there were a fist fight in the streets. And I saw this once when I was at one of my pilgrimages in China, where I came down. I was at Wutaishan, and I came down from the top of the mountain there. And in the little town, there was a huge crowd of locals, and in the middle was some kind of entertainer, someone who was demonstrating that his abilities as a strong man or something like that. This is a long time ago, and people were just enthralled with he was kind of a salesman, barking and striding around in the middle of this circle and entertaining people. There was occasional laughter, and he was swaggering around, and they didn't have TV or movies. They had to make do with whatever excitement they could find. And this was the order of the day. And arguing back and forth, they could come to no agreement. And now, in my mind, I see Weinong, after his 15 years out in the woods, I see him sort of emerging from the woods there at the edge of the monastery, striding up to this crowd. You see them, turn around and look at him and part, like in the movies, the crowd parts, and he walks in, and they all turn to him, and then he says, "It is not the wind that is moving, it is not the flag that is moving, it's your mind that is moving." And that's the nub of the koan, the statement that the student has to show her or his understanding of by demonstrating it, what's going on there. The two monks were struck with awe. What are we to make of this? It is your mind that is moving. There are those who think that when he said that, he was referring to their discursive minds, their mind of argumentation, their small m mind, and that it's just twitching, and their minds are restless, and this is the result, this argument. But that may have been true with these monks, but it's not the point of the koan. Otherwise, he might have said, "Your minds are moving." Here it's singular. It is your mind that is moving. What is this mind? This unborn Buddha mind, this marvelously illuminating mind. unborn Buddha mind, which goes by many other names: true nature, original nature, essential mind, mu, true self. Our face before our parents gave birth to us, the sound of one hand, some 500 years later, the man considered the founder of Japanese Rinzai Zen, a Japanese man, Eisai, tried to describe this mind in his own way, knowing that, of course, he wasn't presenting the thing itself. Or maybe he was in the way that he said this. But these were his words: "Great is mind. Heaven's height is immeasurable, but mind goes beyond heaven. The earth's depth is also unfathomable, but mind reaches below the earth. The light of the sun and moon cannot be outdistanced, yet mind passes beyond the light of the sun and moon. The macrocosm is limitless, yet mind travels outside the macrocosm. How great is space, how great the primal energy. Still, mind encompasses space and generates the primal energy. Because of it, heaven covers and earth upbears. Because of it, the sun and moon move on, the four seasons pass in succession, and all things are generated. Great indeed is mind." It's mind, this mind that Lao Tzu was referring to when he said, "Behind the divisible, there is always something indivisible. Behind the disputable, there is always something indisputable." Wei Nung was making the same point there in that crowd to the two monks. The word religion comes from a root word, religare, which means to bind together. And this suggests the sense in which Zen can be called a religion. There is a way in which it cannot be called a religion in the Western sense. There's no creator God. But in sitting, we are binding together these fragments of reality, such as we see reality. We are binding all this together and coming to see little by little, or maybe all of a sudden at once, coming to see the indivisible nature of this one mind. Essentially, in truth, there's nothing we have to bind together. There is only this one mind. But our perceptions are such, as a result of our false conditioning, that we perceive reality as divided, fragmented. In this sitting meditation that Wei Nung referred to in the passage we read a few minutes ago, in this sitting meditation, we're not really doing anything. We're allowing thoughts to settle so that we can see things as they are. one. As for this argument between the wind or the flag, to get Buddhistic about it, we could point to the law of dependent co-arising, that we can't say that there would be a flapping flag without the wind, and certainly there couldn't be without the flag. They co-arise. As do all phenomena. There would be no flapping flag without the wind. No thing exists apart from every other thing. That's one way to understand the essential experience of Buddhism, which is the experience of no thingness, shunyata. No thingness really means no thing apart. No thing apart. Everything is a part of everything else. It doesn't take a lot of reflection to come to accept that everything is interdependent, and that seeing things fragmented is not seeing things as they are. I ran across this passage I've read a few times over the years in Taisho about birds, migrating birds, flying in formation, and it's a marvelous analogy for the differentiation within unity and the unity within differentiation. This is the twofold nature of reality. And it is the quintessential analogy, metaphor, for Sesshin, this amazing phenomenon that we call Sesshin, and how even as each of us individually has our own work with our own karma, we are all embedded in this organism, this amazing organism that has a life of its own. I'm going to read it. This is from a book called Sensitive Chaos by Theodore Schwenk. And the chapter is The Creation of Flowing Forms in Water and Air, and we might say in Sesshin. I'll just start right in. Each bird, think of the V formations of geese that fly overhead here, each bird lies on a wave which is made in the air by the leader. The beats of their wings follow the ups and downs of the wave, and simply make visible what, as a vibrating aerial form, surrounds and bears them all in the arrow formation. Each bird flies in a fixed position in the aerial form, and the form itself unites all the individual birds. a bird does not need much strength, for it is as though the movement of the wave of air were to raise and lower its wings for it. If one of the birds has an excess of energy, it will do more than simply allow itself to be carried along. With the beating of its wings, it will strengthen the whole wave, will infuse the aerial form with energy, from which all will benefit, who would on their own account no longer have the strength to fly. These take energy from the whole moving field of air. Indeed, even the leading bird itself draws energy from this field. Schifferstein, as I remember, he's the scientist who really worked on this. Schifferstein says, the current error that the bird flying at the apex of the triangle has to work considerably harder than those following it must be corrected. The wave of the field of air streams, created reciprocally by all the separate birds, spreads out in space with the speed of sound, and therefore, as the speed at which the birds fly is much slower, it precedes them considerably, so that the leading bird can, if necessary, take energy from the field just as can all the others. And then the editor continues, the arrow formation is a totality in which the separate birds lie embedded like organs. A new body has been created out of air in which, as with the body of sound of an orchestra, the single instrument to a great extent merges into the whole. It is, however, a necessary part of the whole. The separate birds are linked together by the surrounding air as though by elastic threads. The air, which connects the birds like an elastic medium, acts like a muscle. It unites the different limbs of the formation into a unity which was not there before, and is caused to do this by a higher being, namely, the group soul of these birds. One might also say that this group soul, or what we would call it, mind with a capital M, this group soul manifests itself in the density of air and acts as an integrating muscular system. The elastic properties of muscles are indeed similar to the elasticity of the air. In a muscle, these properties of air are simply embodied and made visible in matter. Thus it comes about that during a long flight over many hundreds of miles, each single bird, elastically connected with the whole flight, beats its wings exactly as many times as all the others in the formation. The entire process is an aerial form, an organic whole moving through the air. The bird is a creature of the air. It is born out of the air and entrusts itself to it. It cannot possibly be abandoned by the air. This is why it's so painful in those rare occasions when someone leaves Sesshin, because all you have to do is just stay in, just keep fighting, keep doing your best, and you will not be abandoned. You will be upheld, you will be borne along by the group energy of Sesshin. Even as your staying in Sesshin contributes to that energy. It's not the wind that is moving. It's not the geese that are moving. It is not the Sesshin participants that are moving. It is the mind, our mind, singular, that is moving. We'll go on to the commentary. Now here Mumon is up to his mischief. It is not the wind that moves. It is not the flag that moves. It is not the mind that moves. How do you see the patriarch? He asks. If you understand the matter deeply, you will see that the two monks got gold when they were buying iron. The patriarch could not repress his compassion, and so we have this disgraceful scene. That too is so much in the Chinese Zen style, is not making something precious out of all this. Mumon would do this over and over again. We see it all through the koans, where he and other masters as well will just, in their irreverence, just say something that's sort of that. Don't get so holy about all this. The geese don't think it's so holy. It's just the way things are. They may not know it in their little geese brains, but but they know it in the way that it counts in their bodies. They function, they embody it. And that's what is the challenge of any koan, is to incorporate it, make it so yourself, so one with it, that you can present it in your body. It is not the mind that moves. Even in this dynamic functioning of our mind, there is this changeless element to it that cannot be certainly empirically proven, that can't be understood with our ordinary rational, reasonable mind, that has to have it either this way or that. Right? Does it move or does it not move, this mind? We find in deep Zazen that even in the movements of our mind, even in the thoughts themselves, there is something that is beyond that. And not just the mind. Xuanzi, the other great famous Taoist master besides Lao Tzu, said, "To the mind that is still, the universe surrenders." This is what practice can lead us to, is this realm where in the stillness of mind, the universe just rolls over and opens to us. Our practice unfolds. It stands revealed. And then Mumon, in his verse, lest any of us get attached to the words of the case or the contradictory words of the commentary, he then says, the wind moves, the flag moves, the mind moves, all miss it and cannot grasp the real thing. Though he knows how to open his mouth, he does not see he was caught by words. Here too, the playful skewering of the sixth patriarch, There's also a very human purpose behind these masters making light of their predecessors, their great, great enlightened predecessors, is because if the more we make heroes out of our teachers, the more inaccessible they become, the more remote they become, and the more we can just throw up our hands and say, well, they were gods and goddesses. They were something superhuman. What they did, sure, okay, enlightenment. But us, me, they're just something else. I can never attain that. So he brings the masters, Mumon and the other masters, bring these guys closer to us with their playful seeming criticism of them. And yet it's also a warning. Though he knows how to open his mouth, he does not see he was caught by words. Yes, he was, in a way, in the sense that as Lin Qi, one of his descendants, great descendants, put it, to speak of a thing is to miss the mark. And that goes for Wei Nong as well. As soon as you say it, then you miss it. And yet, he was using his own means to illuminate what is so difficult for ordinary people to grasp. And so we have in Zen the distinction between the type of words we use. If we're explaining in a dry, abstract way, this is what we might call dead words, but live words is something else. Live words are informed by the wealth of experience, and they come from one's center and not just from the discursive mind. They come from the body, in other words, the whole of the person. But words, we can become, especially in Sesshin, sensitive to how words can just get in the way of the real expression, the real communication. I trust that people, as they go on in their practice, can come to appreciate the eloquence, for example, the eloquence of a simple bow. If your mind is present, if your mind isn't somewhere else as you're bowing, but you're right just fully there, your mind is quiet, and you're aware of what you're doing, and nothing is going on in the mind, there's just the movement. What more eloquent way is there to express gratitude? It always, I always flinch a little bit when people in getting up in Doksan, getting up from the student mat and going back to bow, as they're bowing, sometimes they say, thank you. I don't say anything about it because I take it in the spirit in which it's intended, but you don't need to say it. If you're there, if you're fully there and you're making that bow, anything more, any words, is too much. And a bow is also so much more than gratitude. It's respect, veneration. It's one of my favorite parts of Doksan is each time bowing to the person as she or he comes in. Bowing to one Buddha after another. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.